Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Symmetry of Souls Weekly, two-hour study of the Urantia Papers. We're seeking to grasp the fifth epical revelation in a synthetic wholeness, and we hope you are too. Tonight, our arc, Racial Origins of Mankind, continues with Paper 61, Section 7. From Paper 58, and yet some of the less imaginative of your mortal mechanists insist on viewing material creation and human evolution as an accident. The Urantia Midwayers have assembled over 50,000 facts incompatible with the laws of accidental chance. We don't have that list of 50,000 facts, but we're reasoning through some of them here on Symmetry of Soul, along with all of you all. I'm Brad Garner, so glad that you're here with us live or in our archive at symmetryofsoul.org. Tonight, it's Dr. Chris Halverson, David Tucker, Justin Armstrong, and you. Won't you join us in our virtual study of this gift to our world? Call up the text as you please and settle in with us. Hello, hello there, Dr. Chris.
Hello, Brad. Yeah, you got me thinking about that passage you read there. It's like, well, okay, you could approach it brute force like that from the bottom up and try to itemize a bunch of scientific facts, or you could just approach it logically from the top down, where it's trivially obvious that it's not all just some magical accident. But that gets us into the discussion I so often stress of remembering that this is a philosophic text, and it is attempting to help us develop that kind of clear, precise insight that can establish the logical frame. You know, then within that frame, you can always putz around and create long adding machine paper lists like they're talking about there of facts. You want to do it from the top down first, so that you're not merely technically right as to fact, but everlastingly wrong in the truth. all right. So, with that oft-repeated reminder to everyone, and greetings to you, Justin and David, and everyone joining us. As Brad was pointing out, we're in the midst of this little thumbnail sketch that they give us at the end of paper 61 of the times, most of the times over which we are considering the racial origins of mankind here in this arc. That's why we dipped back into paper 61 rather than starting at the beginning of paper 62. It's just a very appropriate fostering of that top-down, big-picture point of view first, before you immerse yourself in any specific segment of details. And so we're reminding ourselves of how mankind came into being in the midst of the Ice Age, and we'll be continuing with that saga of the Ice Age during the geologic epoch known as the Pleistocene, as we introduced last week. Maybe just a little comment up front that for some there might have been a bit of a fire hose in the mouth trying to absorb lots and lots of details. Remember this is a thumbnail sketch, so things are coming kind of fast and furious. But we'll keep our, doubling back and trying to make sure everyone comes away with that, that basic big picture within which you can organize the details better and begin to try to overcome, either what education you've gotten that might touch upon these sorts of issues, anthropology, archaeology, geology, what have you, or just least if you start investigating on your own, you know, what scientists have to say about some of these things, it can get very confusing because they're doing anything but working top-down, starting with the big picture. They're hopelessly lost down in the weeds of the facts and just endlessly split hairs until they're infinitely confused. So there's lots of opportunity here with the revelation to have that big picture in which you can begin to make some sense out of lots and lots of endless scientific details. All right. Well, with that, we'll see some of the specifics when we jump in. But hope everyone enjoys as we finish up this little thumbnail sketch.
Yeah, thank you for that, Chris. I think that's a very timely and apropos thing to say. I take for granted that I actually took geology courses and had something resembling a degree in it, and so I appreciate all these details, but they can be pretty – you could befog yourself if you get lost in all of them. I don't know. Maybe there's a place to pause and look up what a drumlin is, or maybe there's a place to just kind of move on, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. I don't know. What does it have to do with your soul? I don't know. That would be the criteria, perhaps. And
I think drumlins are kind of like those speed bumps that the angels build. So it does have something to do with your soul.
We'll puzzle over all that in just a bit. Yes, David, good evening to you. How are you, sir?
Hi, good evening, Brad. Hello, Dr. Chris. Hello, Justin. I've got my elbow pads, knee pads, and helmet on for those speed bumps, and I brought a few extra towels for that fire hose to the mouth. I'm ready for tonight's reading.
All right. Oh, I'm glad to have you here, as always, suitably attired. Real quick, Chris, I did want to say, you know, I was thinking about the 50,000 facts of the Midwayers, and I just wonder, you know, is this what you do when you have somewhere between 500,000 and 37,000 years of time on your hand? And, you know, do they, like, throw a party every time someone comes up with a new one now because they figured out most of them early on? And, like, is it a really big deal? Inquiring minds want to know. But it's not our business right now. And Justin, good evening to you. How's everything out your way, and what can you tell us about what we were up to last week?
Good evening, Brad. Good evening, Dr. Chris, and good evening, David. I'm well, and yes, I have a summary of last week's study, and here we go. The Father bestowed a fragment of his deity nature to be subservient to our will. He has eternally chosen to be an existential and immutable center, a foundation in which an ever-changing experiential sphere may extend in both the outer life and the inner life. This eternal choice was predicated on the significance of relationship. The Father chose to limit himself to be contained within the first center so that he might have a relationship with other persons. Only a person can love and be loved. UB 1:7-3. We are created in the image of God. Only a God-knowing individual can love another person as he loves himself. UB 16:9-8. Love is something that you can't do if you're not whole. And you can't be whole if you do not have a center. That center is established by being born again through faith, a genuine faith in the existential and immutable center of God. We began our reading in paper 61, section 5, the early ice age. Our story begins with an ice age at roughly 2.1 million years ago in the Pleistocene, or most recent geological period, having just completed the 10-million-year Pliocene, or more recent epoch. In reflecting on the study of Earth, remember that the providential nature of experiential deity is superimposed upon the geological and evolutionary process of planetary development. The linear aspects of change suddenly transition into exponential growth. The purpose of supremacy is woven into the fabric of material reality. We are seeking a recognition of the truth of the sequence regarding these geological periods. This allows for the scientific facts to be framed in the context of the preeminence of the revelation. In searching for true science, we must begin with the true metaphysics that frames that science, allowing it to be true. Revelation is the only technique which can compensate for the absence of the truth sensitivity of moda in a material world. Revelation authoritatively clarifies the muddle of reason-developed metaphysics on an evolutionary sphere, UB 103-6. Prior to the Pleistocene period, mild climates had prevailed over the northern regions. The combination of 30,000 feet high elevations in North America and Northern Europe, the shifting of the ocean currents, and the directional change in seasonal winds led to constant precipitation. The snow continued to fall until it had attained a depth of 20,000 feet, eventually morphing into solid but creeping ice. The meaning of life is its adaptability, UB 103-4-7. This glacial period would provide primitive men with a stimulating and difficult environment to adapt to. The northern regions experienced six separate and distinct ice invasions. The difficulty in our current scientific framing of the early ice age is due to the scores of advances and recessions associated with the activity of each individual ice sheet. Mammalian life arrived approximately 50 million years ago at the beginning of the Cenozoic or recent times era. Roughly 2.1 million years ago, the first North American glacier started its southern advance. These first two ice invasions were not extensive in Eurasia. Traditionally, the Stone Age is broken into three categories: the Lower Paleolithic, the Middle Mesolithic, and the Newer Neolithic. For the purpose of continuity with the revelation, Symmetry of Soul will refer to the time up to 2 million years ago as the Lower Eolithic, from 2 million to 1 million years ago as the Middle Eolithic, and from 1 million years to 500,000 years ago as the Newer Eolithic. Homo erectus, upright man, lived during this most recent or Pleistocene period. During the transition from the Lower Eolithic to the Middle Eolithic Stone Age, primitive tools were significantly improved. Upon this foundation of Homo erectus, there were no less than 7,000 potential human strains. We read in UB 65-3-4 the following: subsequent to the appearance of Andon Infanta, and before the mutating human potentials of animal life were exhausted, there evolved no less than 7,000 favorable strains which could have achieved some sort of human type of development. Between the ice invasions, the climate was about as mild as at present, perhaps a little warmer. If this fact appears startling, remember that life on this planet has meaning, and once again, the meaning of life is its adaptability. Paper 61, Section 6, Primitive Man in the Ice Age. Regarding the evolution of primitive man, the first man, there were three vital mutations that suddenly appeared. The dawn mammals suddenly appeared, the mid mammals suddenly appeared, and the primates suddenly appeared. The simian ancestry developed from a retrograde within the mid-mammal stock. There is a common truth to be recognized between these phase changes or sudden transitions in the evolutionary system, and many biblical passages, including the following concerning Saul from the books of Acts. And as he journeyed, he came near Damascus, and suddenly there shined round about him a light from heaven, Acts 9:3. Urantia was registered as an inhabited world 1 million years ago when suddenly there was a mutation within the stock of the progressing primates, resulting in the first two human beings. This happened during the third glacial event, providing an opportunity for early man to develop in the context of a stimulating, invigorating, and difficult environment. The newer Eolithic phase, the Dawn Stone Age, ranging from 1 million BC to 500,000 BC, is filled with rugged potential. Directly following this age, the colored races suddenly appear on Urantia. And there ends the summary.
Thank you so much, Justin. That was terrific. As always, your cadence and pacing is very much appreciated. Your flourishes of bringing in quotes from the book. You got a style. I dig it.
Yeah.
Thanks, man.
And your writing about the commentary was beautiful. I love that you chose those quotes.
Thanks.
Yeah,
man.
It was helpful to think back. You know, there was a lot of high-level framing material last week, and as Chris said, a lot of fire hose kind of detailed concepts. It was a bit of a roller coaster. A lot going on in there. Does anyone have anything that jumps out at them from Justin's summary? Anything to clear up or anything on your mind?
Yeah, just a little technical point. When you divide Eolithic, or as we'll see subsequently, when you divide the Paleolithic into three parts, the oldest is the lower, yes, and the one in the middle is obviously the middle, but the newer one is called the upper.
Okay.
In contrast to lower. So it's the upper Eolithic. I think there was a couple times there when you were referring to it. You know, it gets a little confusing because you have the old, the middle, and the new Stone Age.
Exactly. I remember from last week you referred to it as the upper, but because the Stone Ages have that older and newer terminology, I carried it over. So thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah, just So within the Eolithic, you have the lower, the middle, and the upper. And as long as I'm bringing that up, let's just remind ourselves of why I introduced that. You might be wondering, it's like, why it's already complicated enough the way it is, Chris. Why are you bringing in these technical terms and what have you? Well, remember that we are trying to examine, quote unquote, the racial origins of mankind, and in order to get to the point where you have a genuine human, you have to, start with animals that have less than the seven adjutants. And over the millions and millions of years, you suddenly get some animals that have, one more adjutant than the ones before that, and then suddenly you get animals that have yet one more adjutant than the ones before them. And so you're looking, at the final stages of that process of building up from the very first single-celled animals that had only the first adjutant, to finally getting to the point where you have an animal that's all it needs is the sixth and then the seventh adjutant, and then it gets encircuited in the Holy Spirit, that mindal self, and those mindal selves, and a personality gets identified to that selfhood, etc. Right, and you have an actual human. And so one of the, when you're thinking about looking back, in digging up bones and whatnot, trying to sort out, this very ancient history, a very clear indicator of where you are in that process of adding the adjutants, an indicator that will get preserved through long spans of time buried in the ground is the telltale signs of the quality of usage of the fourth adjutant. You know, that that basic, you know, then in a full human sense is a scientific impulse. You know, when you approach it from the top down, it's the spirit of knowledge, etc. The fourth adjutant. It's that fourth adjutant that when it begins to function in an animal, that animal can begin to conceive of a tool. Right? You get tool-making animals. Okay? And so, you know, that's the whole point of, you know, these, when you're breaking up these human cultural ages in the earliest times, you know, it's relative to the type of stone tools that these creatures made, and that you can, you know, either just find by themselves in a certain stratigraphic layer, or, you know, you can find with some residual bones of some of these creatures. Okay, so it's that hallmark of the fourth adjutant, you know, and it's going to be initially of being utilized at a relatively low quality, you know, and then there's going to be a point when you know, there's an uptick in the quality of the creature, you know, which will manifest an uptick in the quality of the tools that they can conceive of making and, you know, actually execute the fine detail of making, you know, based upon the urge of their fourth adjutant. Okay, and so we've got this Dawn Stone Age, this EO Dawn Lithic Stone Age. We'll talk a little bit more about the motivation, again, for introducing the Eolithic in addition to the Paleolithic, but just, you know, take it as a given for the moment. And so, you know, just to, you know, to reemphasize, when you're talking about that lower Eolithic, you're talking about the oldest, crudest stone tools that we've found, and you notice that circa 2 million BC, there, you know, is this quite significant upstep in the quality of those stone tools that creatures mm-hmm. were making.
Right.
Okay, and you also notice that there's you know, all over the world there's this uptick in the quality of the creatures that you find the bones of as well. You know, and as I was saying last week, you know, we can take the human, you know, the scientific term Homo erectus, and treat it with even kind of more precise generality than scientists currently use that term to indicate this transition. You have creatures prior, right? They're not humans. Right, but they are getting to be fancier animals. Okay, and so, you know, prior to circa 2 million BC, you have, you know, very primitive creatures making relatively primitive tools. You know, and then you get this less primitive creature springing up in many places. You know, Justin reminded us of the quote from paper 65, you know, about how many different strains the over control of evolution was working on, you know, trying to take things up to the human level in many, many, many different strains. And so you have this, but you have across all those strains, you have this up-stepping. You have this over-control uplifting, you know, that produces, you know, this generalized type that we can call Homo erectus, which is able to produce a much higher quality tool now based upon his higher quality usage of the fourth adjutant. Okay, and so that begins the middle Eolithic. Those Homo erectus-like creatures, thousands of different strains, and these significantly, less, quasi-random-looking tools. You know, they go like, okay, well, that isn't just some sort of accidental chipping. Right? You get these very, relatively much more precisely chipped tools. And mm-hmm. So, right, so you're going, so, you know, you go forward from circa 2 million B.C., up until in the midst of all of these different strains that we can, with a newfound specificity, we can just call in general Homo erectus, you get, a very high-quality version of Homo erectus appears, which the Revelators call the Andonites, because of Andon and Fonta being the designations they give for those first two of these individuals that don't just have the first five adjutants, at an even higher quality than creatures before, but now actually have the sixth and seventh adjutants and are encircled in the Holy Spirit and are personalized, mindal selves. So at circa a million B.C., we have that in the midst of the Homo erectus, this high quality strain, and you still want to think of it as one of these strains of Homo erectus because, in the sense of calling something a Homo erectus, you're just kind of thinking biologically, and those Andonites are biologically compatible with all those other strains of Homo erectus, and lots and lots of those subsequent generations of Andonites, unfortunately, backmated with many of those subhuman strains. But nonetheless, you're obviously going to have, a further uptick, in at least the potential quality of tool making subsequent to, a million B.C. And so, as Justin was saying, and we're in the midst of kind of talking about that third of these subdivisions of the Eolithic now as we start reading tonight, the upper Eolithic is going to extend from the origin of the Andonites, this sort of highest quality Homo erectus, an actual human strain, going all the way forward until a very auspicious event circa 500,000 B.C., right? And that will be our upper Eolithic span. And then when we get to 500,000 B.C., like I said, I'll remind everyone, again, why it's important to resurrect this Eolithic designation to differentiate this span from the subsequent Paleolithic.
One thought that comes to mind in reflecting upon that mid-Eolithic period, in the same way that you're describing the significance in that transition in tool making in connection to the fourth adjutant, when I think about the fifth adjutant, you've touched upon in the past the human quality of culture in contrast to the mere animal capacity to have a social component. And I'm wondering in that mid-Eolithic period if there's also any sort of evidence or anthropology that is specifically focused upon how Homo erectus was socializing from 2 million to 1 million prior to the genuine human being arriving on the scene. Is there any indication of something similar with that fifth adjutant really taking root?
Yeah, I mean, obviously these creatures all have the fifth adjutant, okay? But it takes on a higher and higher quality, and you can just even in, when you don't look so directly for archaeological signs of a more fifth adjutant social collective
mm-hmm.
expression of these creatures.
Right.
The sophistication of society it takes, to actually being much more systematically producing tools, finding the raw materials and, setting up the organization for the production of all these tools instead of just, randomly finding some pebble and initially noticing, wait a minute, this one got chipped. Oh, yeah, I bet that happened when a rock hit it. Oh, I could hit a rock on it and make another chip. And, it becomes a much more systematic phenomenon just to produce that level of technology. You can't do that without the fifth adjutant.
Hmm.
Right? Because in and of itself, the fourth adjutant in an individual, is not giving him any sense of working with others on this or sharing with others or anything like that, right? Let alone working together more, to utilize that technology and, to process the greater food that you're able to now acquire and you want to store and save for the winter or things like that. I mean, all those things that the fifth adjutant can bring in. Okay, on top of that, just raw technological ability with the fourth adjutant.
Well, thank you. That's helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like I said, our job here isn't to explore all the endless scientific data here that's been dug up, literally. Right, but people can investigate for themselves, and just keep in mind, to sift through what you're reading and separate the actual facts from false interpretations. Which includes inaccurate dating, for all kinds of reasons and whatnot. Okay, but again, the fifth ethical revelation is trying to help us have that framework. But then, we can take the data and say, okay, I see how this basically fits in. Like if you look a little bit at stone tools, you'll see what I'm talking about that transition around 2 million BC. It's very striking. It again kind of speaks to the over control of evolution, that you don't just have this happening in one place and spreading. But of course, current science thinks that it has to happen that way. It's just sort of an accident in some location and then it gets spread. But it's actually happening, all across the old world, where you have these creatures, and they're all moving upward simultaneously in parallel. That phenomenon is completely, not part of current thinking because, right, there's no over-control in neo-Darwinism. Right, it's just a magical bubbling up from the bottom,
right.
And lightning doesn't strike twice, as it were, right? I mean, the magic has to be extreme, and so, you can maybe just, squint properly and imagine it happening in one place, but it's not going to happen, 7,000 places all at the same time.
Well, this might be as good a point as any for me to do my I don't think it's semi-annual. No, I don't think I do it that often. But periodically, I think on Symmetry of Soul, I sort of feel the need to atone for very poor quality thoughts I had in my past. And the reason I bring it up is not for my own sake, but like maybe you're entertaining this too. This is just another line of thought I was on. You know, we haven't said it yet on this arc, but we're fond of saying this is one evolutionary system. All of the cosmos works together to God's, you know, to further God's purposes. But even as I was reading the Urantia book in college, taking geology classes, I had this peculiar view of the cosmos that said, well, okay, so God is acting. Sure, I read about that in the Urantia book. But basically, God must have shown up on the scene, and all of the physical nature, all of the atoms and all the planets, they were just kind of random. They weren't, you know, purposed or anything. And God sort of looked at them and said, well, I guess I can work with this. I guess I can kind of... All right, I guess I can make a silicon-based life form over here. See, too much Star Trek. And a carbon-based one here. So I just had this warped idea that it's not one evolutionary system. It's one big accidental mess that then God retroactively tries to systematize and make some order out of.
No, God isn't
I'm
MacGyver.
Sure that that's... That's great, exactly. Well, I watched a lot of MacGyver, too, so that must be it. But it's just I wonder if that's not a somewhat common thought amongst people who probably have some very muddled ideas about how the Earth can be old and yet God can also, you know, exist in the universe. And I just thought I'd bring it up here in case any one of our listeners entertains that idea, just so we can say, no, it's one evolutionary system. Every atom, everything is purposed to this end. The geology itself, the moving plates, the volcanic action, it's all purposed.
You know what the sentence that comes
with
to mind?
With a singular purpose, you know, again, just to stress, you know, all of that purposed energy, right, just physical energy that has energy pattern identified to it, okay, you know, and every personality, right, all of those individual patterns, be they energy pattern or spirit pattern or personality, right, they all go back to a single pattern reservoir. Right? You know, the purposing that an oxygen atom has was bestowed from the exact same reservoir as the personality that each of us has.
Right.
Yes.
It's a singular pattern reservoir. It's a singular purposing, hence. Right? And so... I mean, when you get out in the cosmos of time and space, you've got all this stuff, things and beings, right? You can kind of get lost in all that, and it's like, well, this must just be a bunch of things randomly going, you know, every which direction and bumping into each other and whatnot. It's like, no, it is a singular purpose. Right? I mean, you know, it's not just sort of metaphorically a singular purpose. It is literally a singular purpose. There is only one purposing, right, in the hands of the purposer.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's why the cosmos is this, you know, inescapably integrated system. Right? There is no cross-purposing. You know, there is just one purpose, and all things and beings respond to that one purpose.
Okay. And hence,
when you get
the
further,
cosmos
go ahead,
is understandable.
Justin, you were going to say something.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah,
just,
go, please do.
When you move sort of farther down the hierarchy there, and you're thinking in the context of mind planned, mind made, and mind administered, there's a passage. The final sentence in 58:6-7 that kind of touches on, I think, what you were describing, Brad, and it says, mind, while not a physical evolution, is wholly dependent on the brain capacity afforded by purely physical and evolutionary developments. So you start to see this interplay where mind is somewhat limited by those processes of physical evolution in terms of its functionality and ability to attune or engage. So it's much more nuanced when you're looking at contrasting something like physical evolution, brain capacity versus mind.
Yeah, but again, you know, it's just sure the attunement of mind is attuned to the biologic evolution. Okay, but the mind energy system itself is evolving.
Yes.
So is the spirit energy system.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's one cosmic system.
All
yes.
three energy systems are part of a triune evolutionary process. Right? And then within that triune evolutionary process, there's the interplay between, one system and another, right, with various, limitations and constraints and whatnot, like that passage is referring to. But, yeah, but just to remember, I mean, one of the reasons why we have any ability to relate to the fifth ethical revelation is the mind evolution, the evolution in the mind energy system that's occurred over recent centuries, even though our biologic systems, haven't really budged at all.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's fascinating.
Okay. So, you can very much see, the evolution of the mind energy system isn't limited, by its, downstepped identification to physical energy systems. Right? It is fundamentally transcendent to physical energy systems. Right, and so, the supreme is evolving. Hence, the mind within the mindful domain of each local universe is evolving. Right, downstepped by that local universe's creative mother spirit, right, all the way down to its focalization on this planet. Right, that focalization of the mind energy system is evolving. Even if the biologic systems aren't being drug along with it.
Yeah. Yeah, reminds me of cosmic growth in the reference that the growth of the parts does not equal the true maturation of the whole. There's something about the whole that is in play at all times.
Yes, and even if you don't go all the way to the contrast of the parts of the whole, just, I mean, down within, the mind energy system is a system of parts. The spirit energy system is a system of parts. The whole, the literal whole, is transcendent of all that in all three energy systems. But the fact that the whole is transcendent of the parts, that transcendence is downstepped into the hierarchy of the parts.
Yes. Yeah.
Right? And so, if you don't like the limited nature of your biology, and how it's not moving forward in any sort of, physical evolution at the pace you'd like to, to be moving forward, well, go up in your mind. Your upper regions of your mind are moving forward faster than the lower regions, parts of your mind that are bound to your biology. If you get all the way up, into the beginnings of cosmic consciousness, that's a stream, a mind stream that's flowing at quite a pace compared to the glacial nature of your biology, pun intended here. It's not just a matter that the upper parts of your mind are higher. They're also moving faster. If you'd like to progress, go up. Right? Irony of people who want to call themselves progressive, they end up just being an ism, a progressivist. They actually go down in search of progress instead of up. They're looking in the exact opposite direction. Right? If you want to really, discover the flow that is progress, become religious. Use the upper reaches of your mind. But so many people, in the name of progress, you know, despise religion and drive themselves as far away from those upper reaches of their mind as their will can do.
They'll look anywhere but toward God, and God is the only true up in the cosmos. So any other direction, you eventually end up looking down. You go into the pit.
Yeah.
You know, there's one quick reference. I actually sent it to Andrea recently. In terms of using those upper regions, that insight, that faith in the upper domain of spiritualized mind, it's from 2 Peter 1, 5 through 7, and it says, "For this very reason, make every effort to add to your faith goodness, and to goodness, knowledge, and to knowledge, self-control, and to self-control, perseverance, and to perseverance, godliness, and to godliness, mutual affection, and to mutual affection, love." And that's clearly an example of what Chris is touching upon here.
Yeah, and, you know, it's also an example that we point out so often. I mean, many a time, especially if it's coming out of my mouth, this is, you know, I'm just trying to remind people of what humans used to know. Like they used to know the Bible, so they knew that passage, for instance. All right? You know, and that passage is in the Bible because it was known, you know, centuries and centuries, if not millennia before that. Mankind has amnesia, as it were. And in more recent times, it's consciously imposed. I will not remember the products of evolution. I will sever myself from the past. I will declare myself transcendent of all that. I am I.
It's even worse. Not only are they just willfully forgetting, but they willfully want to start from scratch.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why when the Revelation, you know, gets around to talking about communism, you know, they make that point. It's like, don't go backwards. You've got these people, you know, who call themselves progressives, actually progressivists, because, right, they think that communism is a, you know, you get to it by going forward. It's like, no, the revelators point out, no, that's going backward, all the way back. It's the most, you know, crude, primitive thought that you can have. It's the antithesis of progress. It's total retrogression. Right. So, you know, there's just, it's so important, you know, to see, you know, like I was saying, to understand why this is happening, why people, in the name of going forward, are going backward at full speed.
Mm-hmm.
It's because there is no forward apart from God. No world goes forward except based upon religious individuals.
Right. And we were born into a time that is trying to forget that, trying its hardest to forget that, but you can't actually do it. I mean, a lot of things can fall apart as a consequence of trying to forget it, but in the end, that's the only way forward. It will be remembered, but it may take a millennia, and it could get rather dark, but we try to shine on anyway.
Yeah, so again, that kind of brings us back around to, you know, we can get reading here now, but just, again, we're reading about, you know, a progression of mankind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, starting, you know, we're with the emphasis on the kind of mankind. You know, the whole most recent domain of creatures that are kind of like actual humans. Right? Because as you were pointing out, Brad, you know, in your little, your episodic reminder you were bringing up there, there's just one evolutionary system. I mean, when you look at all life, the evolution of all life, that's all the evolution of humans. It doesn't matter if it's a plant or an animal or what it is.
Right.
All of that is just the fact of human evolution, right, and its auxiliary phenomena. There really is only one evolution, and that's the evolution of will creatures, and everything else is, you know, is either scaffolding for that process, or the residual foundation for that process. Evolution is on a world is the evolution of humans. And so when we're looking at things prior to a million BC, right? Even though you don't literally have Andonites yet amongst all those Homo erectus, or even before Homo erectus, right? In truth, that's the evolution of humans that you're studying there.
Yeah.
Right. Long before you have the fact, and you can see that that in truth it's the evolution of humans, because it's obviously not some sort of bizarre coincidence that you have upwards of 7,000 different strains, all as actual human wannabes.
Right.
I mean, that's obviously the truth of human evolution manifesting there in those facts.
But with the wrong set of assumptions, you would never look out there and try to see 7,000 strains in the archaeological record all evolving favorably simultaneously, because you wouldn't be expecting to find it. Your assumptions would tell you could never find it because it wouldn't happen. And yet,
And I think Chris, you might have made this statement. Instead of just thinking of the 7,000 strains, I think once you made the statement, there are an infinite number of ways that truth can be made fact. So to just always keep that in mind.
Yeah, that's just 7,000 strains on one world. It's a big universe of universes. Lots and lots of strains. Right?
On
trillions of worlds.
One thing that I love that, Justin, that you included at the end of your summary, I think it's important, right, as we're about to read too, is that this evolutionary process occurred in the context of a stimulating, invigorating, and difficult environment. And, we tend to think of something as being progressive as easy. Forward, we tend to think of as effortless, skipping along as everything goes good and goes my way. And this is an important lesson. I'm really glad you included that in your summary.
Yeah, and we'll touch on that as soon as we start reading.
Mm-hmm. We are in paper 61 of the Urantia book, The Mammalian Era on Urantia, section 7, The Continuing Ice Age, on page 700 of the original single column of these papers. Throughout the glacial period, other activities were in progress, but the action of the ice overshadows all other phenomena in the northern latitudes. No other terrestrial activity leaves such characteristic evidence on the topography. The distinctive boulders and surface cleavages, such as potholes, lakes, displaced stone, and rock flour, are to be found in connection with no other phenomenon in nature. The ice is also responsible for those gentle swells or surface undulations known as drumlins. And a glacier, as it advances, displaces rivers and changes the whole face of the earth. Glaciers alone leave behind them those telltale drifts, the ground, lateral, and terminal moraines. These drifts, particularly the ground moraines, extend from the eastern seaboard north and westward in North America, and are found in Europe and Siberia.
Okay, so, right, besides the immediate sort of, getting your bearings scientifically that they're laying out there, what's the point of that paragraph? It's not merely an overshadowing, it's an over-controlling. And we've just been stressing this. The evolutionary process is over-controlled. And that over-control arches over everything. they're saying, just think about how sweeping the consequences of the immediate physical over-control of glaciers is on the topography. It changes everything. Right? That over-control of evolution changes single-celled animals into will creatures. It moves rivers and, changes coastlines and what have you. Right? And it's all one vast over-control of endless change. For everything that's under, for everything upon which the shadow is cast, to go back to their word there. So, that dominance, right? And like you were saying, David, hearkening to Justin's review, right? If you drop back two paragraphs there in the preceding section, right, you've got that statement. They're reminding you of that again, that we were born and bred in a stimulating, invigorating, and difficult environment. Okay? The whole point is, is that, there is this total purposing, right? I mean, which you can take back to the will of the Father, right? And it's our job as free will creatures, unlike physical purposed energy, to choose to align ourselves with the will, right? In that glacial hardship is the will of the Father. Use your insight to find it and strike step with the truth of it. It's stimulating you to some end. What end? Right? Eventually standing on the aisle with the Father. That end. Right? But a blob of protoplasm doesn't do that, in and of itself. It has to choose to follow the stimulation of the Father from the environment, right? And it's a difficult environment. It's the inevitabilities, right? Because only the unnaturalness, right, of our potential, is survivable. If we don't challenge ourselves above the naturalness, well then the glaciers will just make potholes and rock flour out of us.
Yeah.
Okay.
I do want to offer.
You'll be a pretty turquoise color in an alpine lake, right? as you're ground into rock flour, but you're not going to stand on the Isle of Paradise.
I certainly appreciate the metaphor, Chris. I did want to not counter, but just another perspective on. I mean, the glacial period, glaciers are a hardship. They are a source of hardship and suffering. And yet, I've puzzled over ever since I began to try to understand God's purposing. I'm like, why glaciers beyond just the hardship of the people who were living then? What about the people that come after the glacial period? And I can't claim to have gotten to the bottom of it, but growing up, I would drive across the American South, and we would just cross the Mississippi River, and all of the geology would suddenly turn to all this fine silt called loess, L-O-E-S-S, and it's basically dust that gets kicked up from the Mississippi River that's been washed down from the glaciers that was, that was rock flour that was ground down. This soil is unbelievably fertile, and you can grow just about anything in it. There's just so many aspects of our world. The glaciers were also a form of providence, offering a world that would be allow us to provide for ourselves, that we could sustain and support ourselves. So I don't know if that made any sense. Glaciers are a hardship, but they also have these products that are then very useful to human beings climbing the civilizational ladder in the aftermath of the glaciers. It's all purposed.
Yeah. Yes, and again, it's my usual dripping air quotes. Coincidentally, no, there's no coincidence in the supremacy of this purposing. It's not some sort of accident that the glaciers produce things like the former lake bed of Glacial Lake Agassiz up north, right? This incredibly rich, flat, fertile soil.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
I mean, again, if you just step back, it's obvious, right, that there's a purposing in play, and the physical things are aligned with the human things. I mean, just again, before they start up the sequence of events again, right, they insert this paragraph at the beginning of this section to kind of remind you, right, so you don't get lost in, okay, so this many, thousands of years ago, blah, 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 happened, and then, yeah. So you want to keep the big picture in mind, right, that you're in the biggest sense, not only when you look at all animals are you looking at human evolution, when you look at all things, you're looking at human evolution. Right? The evolution of the planet is part of human evolution.
That's right, yeah.
Right? Right, and to see it in that amazingly grand truth.
It reminds me of law of life itself and not the rules of its conduct. It kind of takes me into that same mode.
Right. We're looking at life itself.
What a terrific concept frame to have. It deepens every year and for me, and I hope it does for every listener. It's a different way to look at the world. It's not one that you probably would have heard in your textbooks if you heard anything about our world in your textbooks in school. But it's glorious. The whole world is purposed and providential.
Truth is beautiful.
But yeah, it is. 750,000 years ago, the fourth ice sheet, a union of the North American central and eastern ice fields, was well on its way south. At its height, it reached to southern Illinois, displacing the Mississippi River 50 miles to the west, and in the east it extended as far south as the Ohio River and central Pennsylvania.
Yeah, so obviously they need to insert this little mile marker here, because we've got the fourth ice sheet, indicated here, for people who are, very novice at thinking about the consequences of the glaciers, on the United, the domain of North America that's now called the United States. Right, when you think about these, three lobes of the ice sheet, the western, the central, and the eastern coming down. Right? I mean, they keep pointing out how the center tends to penetrate the furthest, right? And then, less to the south from the eastern and the western. Well, if you just look at the rivers of the United States, you can see that fact. Right? I mean, you got the Mississippi running straight down the middle, okay, but you got the two main branches, right? To the west is the Missouri, and to the east is the Ohio River, okay? And see that basically, right, where the Ohio River flows, diagonally, southwest, right? I mean, that's, going down, that eastern lobe. I mean, that's roughly how far to the south that eastern lobe penetrated, right? And and the river gets farther and farther south as you go towards the central lobe, because the central lobe went farther south. Same way with the Missouri, right? Flowing diagonally southeast,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
That's going along that margin, right, of of the western ice sheet. At times, you might literally have had those rivers flowing right along, the front face of the ice. You know, there's a mile high wall of ice, with a river flowing down the bottom of it, right, along its margin.
Certainly feels someone could imagine it's the edge of the world. You can imagine people understandably thinking that's the end of the world.
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. So you just have this great big V of rivers, from west to east, coming down the left side of the V of the Missouri and then going up the right side of the V of the Ohio. I mean, that's, basically everything to the north there is where the ice was, right, or another.
When you think of something as simple as veins in the human body and oxygen moving through these veins, and you apply the same concept with water on land masses, it's like, of course there's got to be a structure where things are moving, where water has the ability to be accessed. So it's quite fascinating in this mode of purposing everything to see similarities to the body itself, the physical body and rivers.
Yeah, and the veins and arteries in your body are a complex network. That shifts, and you've got that complex network of the rivers, right? I mean, again, there's lots of sort of immediate analogies that you can think of like that. Right? But a lot of this is just trying to help you. Help you see, right, in the continent that you live, right, the consequences of what we're reading about here. It's just right there, easy to see, right? Why do those two big rivers flow in a V down to the Mississippi? Well, it's because of the glaciers, and the fact that you had this differential amongst the three fields.
And here I am on Symmetry of Soul, in theory a degreed geologist, having never been taught that before. But thank you, Chris, for filling in. I get another in a long series of gaps in my miseducation. Thank you. All right. In Asia, the Siberian ice sheet made its southernmost invasion, while in Europe the advancing ice stopped just short of the mountain barrier of the Alps.
Yeah, so this is another one to highlight, just how far south you had with the fourth one here. And so again, can't remember, was it you, Justin? I think that was maybe in your review that was, it was. You were highlighting about how I commented last week when they mentioned all of the lesser, back and forth of these glaciers, in the midst of the six big movements, and how complicated that makes it. Well, there's also the fact that if you had things not going as far south in the first and the second and the third, then along comes the fourth, snow plows over all that, and it becomes very difficult at times to figure out, what the previous ones did when a subsequent one, goes even further south than any of them did, and just mows over everything that they did. Yeah, so just a reminder of that about how difficult it's going to be to deduce all of this right from the geologic record. We can get rough senses, but you need the revelation to give you the really big picture, within which you can frame things.
Yeah. Yeah. I once had a geology professor who described geologists as like Sherlock Holmes-like investigators who've arrived on the scene after the crime happened, and you're trying to deduce what happened. But of course this geologist would have had no idea that there's also revelation, which is kind of like the equivalent of having a a camera that was recording, and someone can tell you, no, then this. Here are some clues that can help you piece it together. He said, all we can do is deduce what happened. But I don't know, Chris, would this be adducing? I don't know my philosophy well enough. Who knows?
Yeah, well, it's just, again, it's that whole bit of just, you know, groping around, you know, without the big picture, you know, and basically
right.
no way
right.
to get it, right? You know, you just, you know, you're counting on some outlying thing. It's like, well, okay, this is a part of, you know, of the second, you know, ice sheet that didn't get, you know, snow plowed over. Yeah, so you can go, okay, we don't know how extensive that second one was, but, you know, maybe, but, you know, we can tell there was a second one. I mean, you know, so you're left to just kind of, you know, get at things very indirectly. Right? It's like, wouldn't it be handy if someone just kind of told you basically what happened and then you could try to sort it out? And that's what they've done.
Yeah. As they say quickly, back in paper 58, the pages of our gigantic biogeologic record unfailingly tell the truth if you but acquire skill in their interpretation, digging through the past layers. We just need to be skilled in interpreting it, and revelation helps. It tells you things you couldn't have known. So.
Yeah. Again, no matter how much you dig and, you know, and chip away at rocks with a rock hammer, you know, you'll never find the geologic metaphysics. You need to be given it.
Right. Very good, apt metaphor. 500,000 years ago, during the fifth advance of the ice, a new development accelerated the course of human evolution. Suddenly, and in one generation, the six colored races mutated from the aboriginal human stock. This is a doubly important date since it also marks the arrival of the planetary prince.
Okay, so here's what we've been waiting for. Finally upon us. You know, another significant boundary point. And, you know, as I met when I was talking about the Eolithic before and why I introduced it, okay, the important fact is, you know, this suddenly... Right, you know, is producing the first Homo sapiens. Right, all we've had prior to 500,000 years ago, you know, is in this rough generalized use of the name Homo erectus, yeah, is that okay? We haven't had Homo sapiens. Right, we now finally we've gotten to the eventually of evolution that suddenly produces Homo sapiens, and so, you know, that, you know, that's a very significant milestone, right? That deserves, you know, a significant change in language, you know, relative to, you know, to the before and after of that milestone. Right? Before it is the Dawn Stone Age, right? The Eolithic. Right? After that, when you actually have Homo sapiens, okay, now it's the Paleolithic. Okay, now it's the Old Stone Age. Well, you know, there's a middle and a new. Right? Yeah, it's the Old Stone Age of Homo sapiens. Prior to that, pre-Homo sapien, right, is just a Dawn Stone Age, the Eolithic. See that. That's why, you know, the fact that you've got that significant milestone, I mean, it just begs you to resurrect the term Eolithic and use it to designate the before Homo sapiens, those dawning times. Okay, and the other thing, you know, it's not just, you know, for the sake of noting it, that final sentence, doubly important date since it also marks the arrival of the planetary prince. Why did the planetary prince and his staff arrive? Right, at that? Because you know, even the Andonites, let alone all the other, you know, Homo erectus and the back-mated Andonites and all that, okay, that whole, all those stocks are, you know, are not civilizable.
Right.
The prince and his staff come as the civilizational uplifters. Right? And so they don't come until you get Homo sapiens, civilizable humans. Right? I mean, that's why, you know, how you can better understand why it's appropriate to use that that species designation of sapiens. Right? That, you know, that wisdom, that knowledge, you know, that sense of the word sapient. Okay, that, see, they're civilizable. They have a high enough quality of mind that they can be engaged by revelators, you know, and fostered to choose civilization. You know, you try to teach civilization to Andonites, you know, and they can't, you know, wrap their mind around what you're talking about. Right? Remember, you know, the Andonites couldn't even, they didn't have even enough imagination to conceive of grandchildren.
Right, right.
They could get of their children, but the abstraction of grandchildren was too much for them intellectually.
You can't build a civilization on that. You can't.
Right.
Yeah.
They're much too in the moment, you know. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. Well, I know we're going to touch on this in later on in this arc. I'm sure we'll get into a lot more detail. But at this high level, does it actually appear, at least, you know, does it appear that they were trying to produce, as you called it, a pre-blended stock of human beings? And then, like, if things had worked out differently, then there would have been no colored races at this half million year ago point. If the Andonites had been civilizable and the Supreme had moved on and reached a point where that was possible, would we have never had colored races and experienced all of the, shall we say, hubbub associated with that?
Well, there's a statement that says that every world has either primary and secondary or primary.
Yeah.
So it's kind
That's
of baked into
point.
The, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, again, the whole, you know, thing of the experiment here in this decimal world is, you know, it's not even a remotely possible, you know, experiment to see. Let's produce civilizable will creatures prior, you know, to Sangix. No, there is no such thing. Right? I mean, you know, the foundation on, you know, on every world is the Sangix, the Homo sapiens, as it were, right? The civilizable man.
Yeah.
Right? You know, they had all kinds of other things in mind, you know, for, you know, why you're bringing in. But, you know, they didn't have, you know, any illusion that they could produce a civilizable, civilizable humans, you know, less sophisticated than Sangix. The Sangix are the minimally civilizable people. I mean,
right.
You know, just look at the world today, right? I mean, you know, you go to areas where it's pretty much just, you know, Sangix stock without very much Andite infusion into it. And it's like, well, if you kind of squint just right, you can imagine them being civilizable.
Right.
I mean, they're minimally civilizable, right? Okay, there. If you go, you know, less than that, you just don't have civilizable, right? So
yeah,
the life carriers
knew that
those Andonites would not be civilizable.
So it was an experiment, but to some other end rather than producing civilizable beings. I mean, there was some reason they conducted it. They're not whimsical.
Again, you know, there's things related to, you know, the offspring that the prince's staff was going to produce, based upon that pre-blended race, and then there's just, you know, all kinds of inscrutable things about producing those Sangix out of that pre-blended race. It's going to infuse into those Sangix a potential to bring them together that is not normally there. You know, in a normal world, you know, in a certain strain, you know, you've got subhuman, red creatures, and then suddenly they become, you know, there's a there's a volitional pair, right, of that, you know, and you have Red Man, right, and then at some time later, right, you know, if it's got all six sangics, you know, you've got orange, you know, subhuman creatures, and then suddenly there's a pair that are born, you know, so, you know, you've got a lot of separation, but here, right, you know, you kind of, you know, all the sangics are pregnant with the potential to blend them because they're coming out of a pre-blended race to begin with. See, so I mean, even though I can't understand the scientific potential of all that, I can get it philosophically. I just described
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
You know, one thing to add to this is when they do, and I don't want to spend too much time, obviously, when they do touch upon Anagar and they in 63.6 and they use the statement, he instituted an efficient tribal government, the like of which was not attained by succeeding generations in many millenniums. And then they say, never again until the arrival of the planetary prince was there such a high spiritual civilization on Earth. Notice that the word spiritual is in the context of such a high spiritual civilization on Earth, to really emphasize there are these heights of potentiality in the Andonites in the context of the inner life, but it's adding to what Chris is touching upon with this word civilization, sort of beginning with Homo sapiens, when you parse that really carefully and look at that word spiritual.
Yeah, and again, they're real creatures. They're circuit of the Holy Spirit. And the Holy Spirit is, is a profound fact. Right? So in the inner life, right, yeah, sure, there's the potential for something profound there, but producing an elaborate scientific civilization? No. Right.
All right. Yeah. I got it. Makes sense. David, would you like to take the reading from here?
Yes. Before I do, Chris, do you recall the instance where they talk about the planetary prince arriving later than typical? I'm thinking about that in regards to you expressing how he came because of this ability, basically, that the Sangre races brought to being civilizable. I'm wondering why they record that delay occurring, essentially.
Well, we can only speculate about, you know, the timing. It's like, why hasn't Maka Venta come yet? Right. There's obviously going to be some sort of calculation about, you know, the relationship between the Sangiks and the pre-existent Andonites, and how that all is assessed. Right? I mean, you're just left, you know, you can only speculate on, mm-hmm. on, you know, what, you know, might go into the timing of the arrival.
Mm. Okay, I just didn't know if there might have been a correlation to the amount of sanguics or something that were present.
We just don't, we don't know enough to really say it definitively. Yeah, and obviously the revelators weren't allowed to be specific there, so.
Mm. Great. In North America, the advancing fifth glacier consisted of a combined invasion by all three ice centers. The eastern lobe, however, extended only a short distance below the St. Lawrence Valley, and the western ice sheet made little southern advance. But the central lobe reached south to cover most of the state of Iowa. In Europe, this invasion of the ice was not so extensive as the preceding one.
And just, as we think about those, notice that, they're not giving us exactly when the fifth advance started. You know, 500,000 years ago during the fifth advance, right? And so, it started sometime prior to 500,000 years ago. So even in giving us some specificity to sort out the Ice Age, weren't always allowed to be too precise, right? Mm-hmm. They can give some clues, but, then they can't say anything else. But again, you know, you can see how they're pointing out that, you know, the difference, you know, it doesn't go all the way down to the Ohio River. No, it's just, you know, it's basically just going over the St. Lawrence Valley, you know, for instance, in the east there. And, you know, all of that variation.
250,000 years ago, the sixth and last glaciation began. And despite the fact that the northern highlands had begun to sink slightly, this was the period of greatest snow deposition of the northern ice fields.
So just a little between the lines, you know, we talked at the beginning, you know, you can certainly get this going when you've got, you know, 30,000 plus elevations, you know, in the, you know, way up in the north there. But, you know, it's not only going to be slowly carved down, right, by the glacial movement, but, you know, crushed down. Because after all, like we pointed out, a lot of that is, you know, is kind of a bulge in the crust, you know, that's kind of being pushed down, a very ancient bulge in the crust. You know, so you're getting less elevation up there, but things keep going because, you know, you're getting more snow. So you can pile snow on top of ice, right, and still have it, you know, starting at a pretty high elevation so that it can slide all the way down to the middle of the United States.
In this invasion, the three great ice sheets coalesced into one vast ice mass, and all of the western mountains participated in this glacial activity. This was the largest of all ice invasions in North America. The ice moved south over 1,500 miles from its pressure centers, and North America experienced its lowest temperatures.
Yeah, so notice how they're pointing out that you're getting some alpine glacial activity too. You know, a lot of times, you know, you can help to sort what's going on with the continental sheets by, you know, sorting out what's going on with alpine glaciers, you know, that are to the south of, you know, where the continental ice sheets are. You know, but they mentioned earlier that you didn't necessarily have a lot of alpine glaciers, you know, always associated with these continental, you know, sheet advances. So, yeah, they're giving you that little clue there of continental and alpine synced up a bit. You know, and you know, remember, you're getting very low temperatures. I mean, you know, if you've got ice all the way down, you know, into Illinois, say, you know, I mean, it's obviously the, you know, the average year-round temperature is below freezing clear down there. You know, and there's going to be permafrost, you know, way to the south of, you know, of the, you know, the southern edge of the glacier. And so, yeah, the, you know, most of the continental United States is, you know, quite chilly, right?
200,000 years ago, during the advance of the last glacier, there occurred an episode which had much to do with the march of events on Urantia, the Lucifer Rebellion.
Okay, and again, you know, you go, well, are they just inserting that as like, you know, aside from, you know, the issues of, you know, the human cultural ages, you know, there was also this Lucifer Rebellion thing. No, you'll see, you know, in a second here, it's important for them to give you that milestone because it has a consequence for a human cultural milestone at 150,000 B.C.
A 150,000 years ago, the sixth and last glacier reached its farthest point of southern extension. The western ice sheet crossing just over the Canadian border, the central coming down into Kansas, Missouri, and Illinois. The eastern sheet advancing south and covering the greater portion of Pennsylvania and Ohio.
Okay, so again, you've got the, you know, the sixth sheet going way down. You know, and you know, they'll mention a little bit. You see, you've got sort of 100,000 years of advancing and then 100,000 years of retreating for that. That's sixth and last extension there of the ice. Okay, but like I said, besides what they're telling you about the glaciers there, the revelators tell you that there's an important event that happened circa 150,000 B.C. Because of that rebellion that they just mentioned. You don't need to turn there, but I'll just point people to remind you that in paper 77, section 3, paragraph 1, it's making a comment about the first Tower of Babel. And it comments that about 50,000 years after the death of Nod, et cetera. Yeah, see, 50,000 years after the death of Nod, which is basically 200,000 years ago. Okay, so in other words, 150,000 years ago is when you had that whole boondoggle, the first Tower of Babel. And what happened in the wake of that? In 77.4.1, paper 77, section 4, paragraph 1, it says the dispersion of the Nodites was an immediate result of the internecine conflict over the Tower of Babel. Okay, so you've got the Nodites kind of staying really close to home, but then they spread out. Well, don't be surprised if that doesn't produce a noticeable uptick in in what's going on archaeologically when you're digging things up, right? And so you get a boundary. We started the lower Paleolithic when we 500,000 BC when we have Homo sapiens, right? And so that lower Paleolithic has a upper boundary at circa 150,000 BC. Right, when those Nodites go out and they're going to produce an influence, right? Because they have a much more advanced sense of things. They're utilizing their fourth adjutant at a much higher level than the run of the mill humans out there. Right, and so it produces the boundary for that. The upper boundary for the lower Paleolithic. So that goes from 500,000 to 150,000 BC.
Goodness.
This is the glacier that... Oh, sorry, were you going to speak to Brad?
No, go ahead.
Oh, okay. This is the glacier that sent forth the many tongues, or ice lobes, which carved out the present-day lakes, great and small. During its retreat, the North American system of Great Lakes was produced, and Eurasian geologists have very accurately deduced the various stages of this development and have correctly surmised that these bodies of waters did, at different times, empty first into the Mississippi Valley, then eastward into the Hudson Valley, and finally, by a northern route, into the St. Lawrence. It is 37,000 years since the connected Great Lakes system began to empty out over the present Niagara route.
Okay. So comment on that last sentence first. There's an example. This is all very confusing to sort out. They're giving you a little solid anchor point there. You first have that route, that produces the initial Niagara Falls, much evolved since its origination, but nonetheless, giving you that date, so that the geologists have that little benchmark that 37,000 years ago is when they can pin that down. And then work around that, and just keep in mind that these lakes have gone through lots of evolution, much smaller, much larger, et cetera, not flowing from one to the other, flowing from one to the other. Right? It's been very complicated as the ice is, initially on top of them, right, that area, and then slowly backing off. And, not only do you have all of the modification of things with the ice itself, but then as the ice leaves, still to this day, that whole region is still rebounding, is going upward in elevation all the time.
Right.
And so obviously, as the stuff bows back up again after the ice is taken off of it, where water flows changes a lot. And how full things are changes a lot. And so there's lots and lots of changes gone on, and difficult to sort it all out with the Great Lakes.
And yet somehow as human beings we don't like it when our environment changes around us. Juxtapose that with what you just said. We're not going to stop the Great Lakes region from rebounding after the ice. And yet some people, I mean, if they heard about it, they might say, well, we've got to start drilling some anchors in and make it stop.
Can't we, secure it to the, the iron core of the earth so it doesn't rebound? No. It's changed radically, over the time that humans have been living in North America.
Yeah.
100,000 years ago, during the retreat of the last glacier, the vast polar ice sheets began to form, and the center of ice accumulation moved considerably northward. And as long as the polar regions continue to be covered with ice, it's hardly possible for another glacial age to occur, regardless of future land elevations or modifications of ocean currents.
Okay, so remember how I highlighted way back at the beginning, that unlike, geologists tend to think, you didn't have Arctic ice, all the way back 2 million years ago, for instance.
Right.
You didn't get that Arctic ice sheet until about 100,000 years ago. And so that's a pretty radical thing for them to absorb, the geologists, that is. And then they give you yet another little reminder about what it takes to get an ice age. Right? I mean, it's obvious you've got to have those land elevations. You've got to have the ocean currents, just so, so that you get the incredible precipitation, on and on and on and on, year after year after year. And it's very important in the whole process to have the Arctic free of ice, the Arctic Ocean free of ice. When we think about, eventually, like they're pointing out here, the only reason that there is ice at the poles is because, that last little bit of the ice age hasn't ended yet. And obviously going forward towards light and life, at some point, there won't be ice on the poles. The oceans will be deeper. Again, will there be an ice age just because eventually, there isn't ice on the Arctic Ocean? No, I mean, everything has to be, just so. And we definitely don't have 300,000-foot elevations up there right now.
Yeah, it's interesting how they phrase that, and as long as the polar regions continue to be covered with ice, it's an interesting way to to state that.
Like I say, there's no question about it. One day there will not be polar ice on the Arctic or the Antarctic, period. The world moves more and more towards being like an architectural sphere. There aren't, ice sheets and whatnot on, Gerasim. Especially by the time you get to the fifth stage of light and life, when the master physical controllers are radically, altering the planet. You know, you want to talk about changes with the Great Lakes. Yeah. Wait till you see what the master physical controllers do to this planet in the fifth stage of light and life. Yeah.
So, we'll be better equipped to tolerate it at that point, hopefully.
Yeah. I know, as much as I like change, I don't think I could handle seeing the Grand Canyon just be, you know, smudged away with an eraser. I think it would bug me. I'm just not ready for that as a human yet.
There's a line, right?
Instead of the Himalayas, there's a giant thumbprint. Yeah, so things will radically change. You know, I mean, not just the surface, but the, you know, all the way to the core. You know, they will stop all radioactivity. You know, I mean, everything will be completely changed.
Yeah.
Justin, would you like to take over the reading?
Sure. Thanks, David.
Yeah, of course.
This last glacier was 100,000 years advancing, and it required a like span of time to complete its northern retreat. The temperate regions have been free from the ice for a little over 50,000 years.
All right, so that statement there, just kind of, you know, in a very first order, you know, sense, like I was saying, you had advance from 250 to 150, and then retreat from 150 to 50. Okay, but we'll see here in a little bit. You know, they don't draw the line sort of definitively to end the Pleistocene. At 50. It's just the temperate regions, right, have been free from ice, but it's still quote unquote the Pleistocene for a little bit yet, after 50,000 years ago.
Real quickly, I can't resist. I like how they refer to it not as ice, but the ice. It reminds me of Save Us from the Curse of the Ice. There's some mild personification going on here, reminding us that humans were reacting to not just ice, but the ice.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
It's like the blob or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
The ice. And also notice the other thing, I don't think we've mentioned, you know, rather than thinking of six ice ages, you know, it's one ice age and six, advances and retreats. You know, and so in that sense too, it's sort of the ice, you know, from first to sixth, it's the ice. Yeah, and like I was just saying, what's there in the north and south polar regions is still the ice. But one day the ice will be gone.
The rigorous glacial period destroyed many species and radically changed numerous others. Many were sorely sifted by the to-and-fro migration, which was made necessary by the advancing and retreating ice. Those animals which followed the glaciers back and forth over the land were the bear, bison, reindeer, musk ox, mammoth, and mastodon.
So be more like them, able to adapt rather than the ones that got snowplowed out of existence. So again, notice what's underlies that statement. You know, remember, bear, bison, reindeer, musk ox, mammoth, mastodon, that's all part of human evolution.
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of think of them as windows into yourself. Right? And then there are the ones, the species that were destroyed by change. Right? You know, survival of the fittest. The only people that make it to paradise are the fittest.
I certainly do feel sorely sifted by life. I resonate with that statement a lot.
Yes. You notice the life carrier couldn't resist the alliteration there. Right. I mean,
yeah.
Again, it's, you know, Jesus said you get into the kingdom of heaven and then you face a severe test.
That's right.
Right. A sore sifting. right? That's what it always is. It isn't just humans that can bring about the end of species, right? God's purposing has brought about the end of more species than humans could ever imagine bringing the end of. Not only, destroying many species, but radically changing numerous others. So again, this false existentialization that we've already pointed out that humans tend to have these days, no, that's not the truth of God's reality.
Right. We do not live in Havona. We just don't.
No.
The mammoth sought the open prairies, but the mastodon preferred the sheltered fringes of the forest regions. The mammoth, until a late date, ranged from Mexico to Canada. The Siberian variety became wool-covered. The mastodon persisted in North America until exterminated by the red man, much as the white man later killed off the bison.
See, notice how before they reminded you of red man killing the mastodons and white man killing most of the bison, they remind you, God killed lots and lots of species before that.
Yeah.
Right. See, so again, it's not saying, because God did it, we have the right to kill as many species as we want. Of course, not such a lunatic, conclusion as that. Okay, but right, they're trying to give you, a contextualization. Mammoths existed as long as mammoths needed to exist, and then they ceased to exist.
And God's ways are wise ways, and they're saying, can we be wise as we look out on the earth now as advancing beings? Just reacting to your thing of like, does that give us permission to do whatever we want? No, we're supposed to be wise because we're trying to be godlike.
Yes, there's a wisdom, in the ebbs and flows of these species over time. By the way, little side note, humans ponder, whether or not it was red man that, brought about the end of the mastodon, or if it was climate change or what it was. It's like, the primary reason was red man. They're constantly giving you little tweaks like that of assistance and sifting through the confusion.
In North America, during the last glaciation, the horse, tapir, llama, and saber-toothed tiger became extinct. In their places, sloths, armadillos, and water hogs came up from South America.
Water hogs, capybaras. People might know them by more
never.
Familiarly.
Never met
they're
one,
calling them water hogs there because that's the literal meaning of the Latin genus, water hog. You're left going, well, wow. I mean, so apparently God doesn't like saber-toothed tigers, but, he has some affinity for armadillos. what's up with that? of course, again, remember what's underlying a lot of this. Eventually, there's going to need to be a place that doesn't have lots and lots of very huge and dangerous creatures where civilization can reach the heights that it can reach. God is clearing the way for the United States.
That is a that is a big statement, but I can certainly, and I'm inclined to agree with it, of course. It's just I can see it from a more geologic point of view. There's the whole Earth's history, the fracturing of the continents, and it drifts over this way. So there's old world, there's new world, and things have to migrate, and the whole system is rigged so that eventually you have a new world continent where things can continue to evolve. I'm starting to see that.
When you finally are up against the walls of the old world, there needs to be a new world. In the same way, eventually you're up against the walls of your mind on the first mansion world, so then there's a new world, the second mansion world.
New world.
Right?
Praise God.
Where the walls aren't so, close in, right? And your mind can expand bigger.
As a child, this reference to the horse in North America, I just associate horses with Red Man. And, in middle school or sometime along the way, you learn that they were introduced and brought over and they weren't native here. But then hear this statement about how the horse went extinct. It makes me wonder if we're looking at 100,000 years back, if there's any sort of cave drawing, anything that indicates that prior to Europeans bringing the horse over.
Yeah. Well, remember, there's lots and lots of fossils and all this sort of stuff. Yeah, so humans are aware of these things.
Interesting. The enforced migration of life before the advancing ice led to an extraordinary commingling of plants and of animals, and with the retreat of the final ice invasion, many Arctic species of both plants and animals were left stranded high upon certain mountain peaks, whether they had journeyed to escape destruction by the glacier. And so today, these dislocated plants and animals may be found high up on the Alps of Europe and even on the Appalachian Mountains of North America.
Yeah, see, so we don't not only have sorely sifted, but we have whither they had journeyed. it's like, wait a minute, am I reading the King James Version of everyone knows the Revelation is written like that. A reminder of how this works and how there may have to be, a refuge that mankind seeks sometime in the future. Not trying to escape the ice, but maybe a black flood of an interregnum.
There's a lot of people that feel that, yeah.
Yeah, so just always kind of be thinking about how, as they tell you these little vignettes about history, how there might be a truth there that could replay factually sometime in the future.
Sometimes there's a literalness to that arrow from the humus. Go up. You just want to go up.
Yeah, maybe the marauding hordes won't find me, way up, secreted in some mountain. Yes. Yeah.
The Ice Age is the last completed geologic period, the so-called Pleistocene, over 2 million years in length.
Yeah, I remember way back at the beginning, I pointed out that, here they say over 2 million, so you can try to make an estimate, of where to draw the line between the Pliocene and the Pleistocene.
Right.
And just, a final reminder, right, I mean, the story started, not at a million years ago, where coincidentally there was an ice age. No, it was 2 million years ago where coincidentally there was an ice age, because the truth of the humans was really definitively manifesting 2 million years ago, a million years before the fact of humans. See, so the ice age is synchronized with the truth of humans, not with merely the fact of humans.
Thirty-five 35,000 years ago marks the termination of the Great Ice Age, excepting in the polar regions of the planet. This date is also significant in that it approximates the arrival of a material son and daughter and the beginning of the Adamic dispensation, roughly corresponding to the beginning of the Holocene or post-glacial period?
And so the Holocene, see, they're having starting at 35,000 years ago. A little point in terms of humanity that they're talking about and how it's going to affect the human cultural ages. They tell you at the beginning of paper 73 that, you know, at 40,000 years ago, in other words, you know, circa 38,000 BC, you've reached that evolutionary plateau, right, ready for an uplift. You know, and so that's going to demark, the end of the middle Paleolithic. It's going to go from 150,000 to 38,000 BC. So we're kind of ending here at the end of the middle Paleolithic in our story, and the beginning, you know, roughly of the Holocene.
This narrative, extending from the rise of mammalian life to the retreat of the ice and on down to historic times, covers a span of almost 50 million years. This is the last, the current geologic period, and is known to your researchers as the Cenozoic, or Recent Times Era, sponsored by a resident life carrier.
Who definitely knows of that which he speaks. One of the life carriers that seeded eukaryotic life. And has been here ever since. Watched all the mountains rise and fall and what have you. I just remembered in that preceding paragraph, notice the way they talk about the ice in the polar regions. See, it's the termination of the Great Ice Age, excepting in the polar regions. So just making sure that you understand that
we're still in
that
we're
ice is part of the Ice Age.
Yeah. Yeah, one, we don't have time tonight, but next week maybe we could touch on this. When you were emphasizing tools in relationship to the fourth adjutant and that being sort of upstepped in Homo erectus, 2 million years ago, there's the passage from 6574 where it says, again, on an average evolutionary world, the seven adjutant spirits are far better synchronized with the advancing stages of animal development than they were on Urantia. Next week, I'd like to kind of maybe touch on that because I find it so interesting that on our world, there's, with the exception of one other sphere in the universe of Nebadon, this process was really difficult. This interplay.
It's because they modify things so much, to get the pre-Sangic will creatures. We can talk that out some more. That's the thumbnail sketch I was alluding to at the beginning. So, they don't take us all the way forward, but, they take us through, into the beginnings of the Upper Paleolithic. Right, the sort of the official, end of the Ice Age, excepting in the polar regions. In other words, the beginning of the Holocene.
Well, it's a terrific journey, and Chris, you've added a lot of richness to it. I've read this paper plenty of times, being a part of some of my favorite papers, being a student of geology, but I didn't piece things together. I mean, it seems so simple after the fact, but, you're just bringing in the Tower of Babel 150,000 years ago. I've never thought to do the math and add this part of the book up to that part of the book. I've been doing things in part-wise fashion, but this is all one whole, so I so appreciate your scholarship.
Yeah. Thank you, Chris.
We'll eventually even see how you can note this. The second attempt at a Tower of Babel even kind of fits into the story.
All right. Well, we are down to about a minute here, so I think we'll call it there. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on Symmetry of Soul here live or in our archive. A quick little reminder, since I've got a few seconds, there is a daily read-through that is now about not quite a month underway. You can find out more at symmetryofsoul.org. There's a nice big banner up at the top. We're spending 5.5 years reading the book a section at a time, and it has already been helpful for this student of the book. I saw some parallels between the forward and paper one, so you can see the daily reading and more on our website. Check it out. Until we meet again, hopefully next Tuesday at the same time and place, do your best to follow the way. Good night.
God bless everybody. Have a great week.
Take care, everyone.
Yes, everyone have a great week. Drop back and focus in on a more precise story. Put it in the context of this thumbnail sketch. So tune in next week. We'll start paper 62. Take care, everyone.